Hey folks, you know, Christmas is coming soon, and if you're like me, you procrastinate, and even though you want to get the perfect unique gift for somebody, you find yourself with limited options. So I've decided to put together a little list to help you out with your last minute shopping. And if you have an arts lover on your list, or if you're one yourself, here's some great gifts, all available from offcamera.com and samjonespictures.com. There's books, there's prints, there's magazines, and they're all really unique one-of-a-kind items. One of the things I could suggest is my new collaboration with Blake Mills called Somewhere Else, which is a coffee table book that comes with a really unique feature. It has a soundtrack. That's right, Somewhere Else, my new coffee table book, comes with a beautiful 180-gram white vinyl original soundtrack of music played by the one and only Blake Mills. And if you haven't checked it out yet, it makes a great gift. So go to samjonespictures.com and click on Shop. And you can always go to offcamera.com and get a subscription to Off Camera Magazine. This is the truly unique magazine that comes out with every issue and can be delivered right to your door. So when the holidays come around, don't just click on amazon.com. Check out some of the more interesting, unique, and limited edition items that we have for sale. Not only will you be giving someone a really personalized gift, but you'll be supporting the show. Thank you. Hello and welcome to another edition of Off Camera. I'm your host, Sam Jones, and in this episode, I sit down with actor, director, and skilled woodworker William H. Macy. When you have the opportunity to talk with someone like Bill, it's hard to know where to start. We only have an hour, and this guy has 30 years of experience in the world of theater, film, and TV, and a body of work that anyone from North Dakota would call, well, real good. We call it amazing. He spent years in the theater honing his craft and developing a renowned acting technique with his friend David Mamet. No slouch in that department either. Then came one of those life-changing moments in the form of a script called Fargo. Though he wasn't originally asked to audition for Jerry Lundegaard, he did it anyway, and hard. Luckily for him and Ethan Coen's dog, it worked out, and it's just one of the many misguided, miscreant characters he's played since. But here's the thing. He doesn't play them as caricatures or outlines. He finds a way to tell us something about why they are the way they are. We've learned about priests and pornographers and drunks, and along with that, what a true artist can bring to a role, namely himself. Shameless came along at a time when Macy found himself less than stimulated by the film work he was offered. He was ready to try series TV, but maybe not ready for how much he'd love it, and it shows in his gleefully reprehensible portrayal of Frank Gallagher. As well as things were going, Macy knew he was ready for another challenge, or thought he was, before he took on the daunting task of directing his first indie feature entitled Rudderless. And, you know, for me, as a fan of storytelling, filmmaking, and music, this was a trifecta. I couldn't wait to ask him about the process of helming a film where the musical score plays such a crucial role in the story. And it's inspiring to talk to someone who continues to challenge himself as an artist, and whose love of his job seems to increase the longer he does it. In this episode, I talk with him about his simple but unbreakable rule in approaching character and story, about how Shameless sent him back to acting school, what Rudderless taught him about directing, and why potheads make great actors. We've never inhaled so much sage advice in one sitting. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hey, Bill. How you doing?
Good, Sam. How are you?
Good. Thanks for doing this.
It's my pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I feel very lucky in this job that I get to really research somebody's life and sort of, you know, indulge myself by looking at a lot of their work. And I found a lot of stuff out about you while I was preparing for this. And
I know what you're talking about. She looked 18 to me. Drinking heavily. And
that's right. Well, I'm deeply offended by that as a man with daughters, but you have daughters too, so I
feel
like
daughters.
We could
insult each other on that level.
That's right. No, but I found out that you, you know, you're a really well-rounded Renaissance man. I mean, you're a woodworker, you are a ukulele player, you are a motorcycle enthusiast, you've made benches for presidents, and I also found out that you are an actor and a director.
Yeah.
Which is fascinating to me. So let's start there. And you know, you've been known to play characters that have been low self-esteem, down on their luck, you know.
Losers, yeah.
Losers. And I wonder if there's a certain
I wonder if that's typecasting that comes from being so successful in Fargo, or if it's that you have a natural affinity for adding humanity to what you play. Do you think about that, or?
I have thought about it, just because I do play a lot of losers. I've done it a lot, and so I've been quizzed on it. I take my cues from the story as I understand it and try to do my part of telling the story. And I've always felt it's my job to bring as much of my personality to the role as I can. You know, I've heard it said what an actor does is subsume his or her personality to a character. And I don't subscribe to that. I think we're all broad enough. We have enough experiences that we can play a lot of different roles. And that what an audience wants to hear is, what do I think about it?
Right, exactly.
What do I think about it?
Exactly.
I think everything is political, ultimately.
Right. If you're a vessel for answering the audience's questions, or that they can live vicariously through you,
yeah.
If you don't bring your own curiosity, then maybe they don't feel that.
And as far as the losers or the despicable characters I've played, I think I've had success because, or perhaps better to say, when I have had success, it's because I don't set aside my sense of right and wrong, my sense of morality. I try to find the answer to, why would you do that? What are your reasons to do that?
Right, right.
On a moral level. So in other words, in Fargo, I thought, it's a story about a guy who's trying to protect his family.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting, and I want to talk about Fargo more, but I read a quote that you said once, which you said it's bad form to view any character you're playing in the negative.
Yeah.
Is that what you're talking about? What does that mean? Is that like judgment? Is that like it's bad to pass judgment on a character you're playing as if you could step back away from yourself?
Yeah, because it's not true to life. Nobody presents as, I'm a stupid asshole. you know, there are a lot of stupid assholes in the world, but they don't think they are. We are all the hero of our own stories. That's the human condition. So you may indeed be playing a villain or a stupid person or a venal person, but the script takes care of that. It's your job to find the something worth fighting for.
Right.
And it's a little bit of a trick. Do you know, are you playing an evil Nazi who likes to murder people, or are you playing a military man who's got the guts to stand up and do what needs to be done? One you can act, the other one you're just going to be Snidely Whiplash, you know, and it's not going to... I've always had troubles being from the South. When I see racism portrayed in films so often, I don't buy it because I think it frightens actors so much to play a racist, someone who just cannot abide black people or Jews or whatever, you know, someone who really hates them. They act it in such a way that it's clear, I don't feel this way. This is just the role I'm playing. And I think they do a disservice to the story. And, you know, as a result, we see the film and we don't know anything more about racism or prejudice than we did before we started. We just saw someone acting out sort of the shell of it. I think it's my job to play the hero in every single role.
That's a great way to describe what that is, not looking at your character in the negative. Because, mm-hmm. yeah, but on the converse of that, how do you approach it? If you're a fearless actor and you're going to play a racist, how do you approach that? I mean, is that a research thing? Is that a mindset? Or is it finding that character's reasoning that... and making it true for yourself for why that hatred is there?
I think you have to look in yourself. And, okay, first it's a trick of technique, in my opinion. This is this thing called Practical Aesthetics, which is the Atlantic Theater Company in New York, this company I'm associated with, and Dave Mamet made it up. And it's basically Stanislavski, but it's just a little more evolved. And the tenet of that, which I find fascinating, is that there's a difference between what the actor is doing and what the character is doing. To the audience, they look the same. You can't tell the difference if you do it correctly. But, you know, if you're standing on the ramparts talking to your troops and you say, what I'm doing here is protecting the kingdom, you're going to be making shit up. Because you're on a set. There's no kingdom. You're not a prince. You're just making shit up. But when you're talking to a bunch of men and you're getting them to swear allegiance, that you can do, because I'll know when they've done it. I can look in their eyes. I can tell you whether I've succeeded or not in real time, right now. And I think the best acting, you set yourself a goal that you can accomplish in real time, right now. Whether you do or not is a function of the script.
And maybe a function of the other actors.
And a function of the other actors. And, you know, that's when the improv just gets fantastic. When you're not getting what you need and, you know, you get this thing going. And even though you're saying the lines verbatim, it's a wild and woolly improvisation. I think that's acting at its best when you don't know what the hell's going to happen.
Wow. Well, I do wonder how much of your technique is at a gut level now to where it's instinctual and you don't have to prepare. Or are you still marking up a script and sort of plotting those things out? I mean, how much is it now that it's just second nature to you versus when you were developing that technique?
Well, there's two answers. I have sort of inculcated all those exercises we did and the theory of acting, and I've got it in my soul. So no, I don't do a lot of preparation. And the second answer is I really should do a lot more.
What do you think?
I think I phone it in sometimes. I think I jump to conclusions. I got cranky with myself a couple of years back. When I started doing Shameless, it was a godsend because I got to act every day, a lot.
Right.
And my lovely wife, at the end of the first season, when we were picked up for the second, said, what are you going to do that season? You got a goal, something you want to work on? I said, what are you talking about? She said, just acting-wise, is there anything you want to work on? And I went, oh, my God.
I've forgotten.
I've got, this is my 10,000 hours. You know that book? This is my 10,000 hours. I could try something. And it might sound foolish and stupidly simple, but, you know, they say one of the marks of actors is that when you listen, you really listen. And you forget that. It's easy to forget. After 35 years, you can forget to really listen. There's a famous Lunt Fontaine thing. He says, I used to get a laugh. When I ask you for a drink, I used to get a laugh. I don't know. I've lost it. And she said, well, perhaps if you ask me for a drink. And you forget to listen. So the second season, I thought, I'm going to cool my jets a little bit and put my attention on listening. And wow, from there, it started to open up. And, you know, it was this my own little studio, and I got paid to practice acting all the time. Normally, in the life of an actor, you sit around all day, and you're waiting for the jobs. You only act about 2 months out of the year.
Right, if you're lucky.
With big pauses in between the days.
Well, yeah, that begs the question of any kind of collaborative artist. How do you stay sharp?
I'll tell you how banal it got. At one point, I thought, I don't know these lines. And I've been doing it all my life. I come and I'm 80% off book, you know? But
right.
The truth of the matter, I would look at myself and I go, you know what that guy's doing right there? He's fetching for that line. What was that goddamn word, you know, and you can't remember it. So I sharpened my ability to learn lines, and I made it a goal that I would know the line. You know, rather than looking at them the night before, I learned them 3 days before so that when I got to the set, I could do them while juggling on a unicycle. I knew them backwards and forwards. And I suddenly loved acting more than I ever have in my whole life. And I had, every actor will know this, you get this experience where you have to do some ugly scene. It's a screaming scene, or it's something where you're humiliated, just a scene that you really don't like. And sooner or later, you get to the point where you're going, really, more coverage? Didn't you get...
Sure.
How much longer? I mean, how many more shots do you have in this thing? But when you know the lines inside and out, man, I'd do it until the cows come home.
Right.
I didn't care what the scene was. I loved acting when I knew the lines so well that they were no longer part of the equation. It was all about me looking and talking and listening and doing all that stupid shit that they talk about in acting class.
That works.
It works. It's great fun.
When you talk about sharpening your talents. I do wonder if there's still a situation that brings you anxiety, or a point in the process or the prep before you go, you know, to set that day. Can you still feel that way about acting?
Shameless. A television show in general is a little bit, I'm in the groove, you know. Where does Frank Gallagher begin and William Macy end? We're one. They're writing for me, and I am Frank, and Frank is me, so that's a little rarefied. I can imagine getting a role that would scare the shit out of me, but I'm not getting those roles these days. But I tell you, I took up directing.
I know, and I want to talk all about that.
The crap out of me. And I haven't felt this alive in a long time. I found myself doing things that I don't know how to do. I'm back as a 20-year-old, and it's been great. It's really been great.
Do you think that perhaps you had some base need to scare yourself? Or, like, what do you think it was? Like, I imagine you've, for a many number of years now, had steady offers, steady work. And to a lot of people, I think that would be enough to go, this is what I worked my whole life for, and here I am doing it. But what made you say, you know what, I want to challenge myself tremendously and you know, turn the whole thing upside down and try that?
Well, I'm ambitious, and I'm nearing the end of my career. And
I hope not.
Well, not Clint Eastwood. If I can still get the work when I'm his age, I will thank the Lord. But I didn't go into directing because I wanted to scare myself. I naively went into directing thinking, I think I could do this better than anybody else. And it was only when I got on the set and artistically speaking got hit by a train did I realize there's a lot I don't know about this.
You know, I saw Rudderless, mm-hmm. and that was, I mean, you call that your first film, even though it wasn't really your first film that you directed, right?
I'd done something for HBO about 100 years ago.
Okay. Well, Rudderless, you know, and I tell everyone, if they haven't seen it, they should go see this film because
Excellent. It
is, I'm a big music guy, and I've made a couple music documentaries, and...
We nailed it, didn't we?
This film pulls off a very hard trick, which is... You're supposed to believe as an audience member that the music in the film has the power to change someone's life enough and make them go deep into themselves and take a different path. And the music that you manage to have in your film is powerful enough to actually
really is.
Do that to people. And you know, right off the bat, I wondered, chicken and the egg type of question, did you have these songs first and say, we should make a film around this, or did you have the script first and say,
no.
We have to find some music?
We had the script and there were placeholders. But I was smart enough to know that probably the most important decision I had to make and the first decision I had to make is, where are we going to get these songs? And we hired a music supervisor, Liz Gallagher, and she put the word out in the indie scene, and a lot of people sent stuff. And I heard a song that I loved, and it was by this guy, Charlton Pettis, and the guy he was writing with, Simon Stedman. And I liked that song, and I listened to another song of theirs, and I thought, I think these are the guys. And in the script, we had placeholders. We said, here's a song about, would you still like me if I was an asshole? Would you be my best friend if I slept with your girlfriend?
Right.
Some song about that. And so I started working with Simon and with Charlton. And it's those guys. They really came up with it, with one exception. There's a song by Fink in there. And I'm really proud of the songs.
I feel like... one of the hardest things you can do, especially with the first feature, where you're really putting it out there that this is a film I'm making, a story I'm telling, is it's a huge chunk of your life to commit to and to say, I know based on this story and this script that I can make a film. And I just wondered if, you know, to pull the trigger and to say, this is what I'm doing, mm-hmm. it's a very hard thing to commit to, I think. Do you have a hard time with that?
I gotta say, I would love to get successful enough as a director that I could have the time and the riches to read a bunch of scripts, find one that really moves me, and say, let's make this movie, and then go off and make it. The indie world, you have to build the boat in the water while you're treading water. You have to build the boat around you. So that script came in, and I called the two writers, and I said, I kind of like this, but not all of it. So we kept working on it. It's about a school shooting and all of this. And when we came up with that big hook, the twist, the unexpected in the beginning of the third act, that's when I knew, okay, I will move heaven and earth to direct this script. But I had to start the whole process of finding money and finding somebody who would do it long before. So it's building a boat when you're in the water.
That's a great way to describe it.
It's not fun.
Right. Well, what was the thing that you were most worried about not pulling off with that particular story?
The film deals with this whole issue of these crazy shootings that happen. And it's about a father who loses his son. And that is so politically charged and so complicated on so many levels. I was very diligent to make sure that everything in the script, we asked ourselves from every single point of view, everybody's point of view, is this true? Even on the days we were shooting, we would revisit it. And there was some writing after we started shooting. So I was worried about that.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, in terms of, you know, I thought the easy answer could have been, you know, the music. And if we don't get the music right, it's not going to have an emotional center. But what you're talking about is, you know, if you get the tone of that wrong, it's such a big event that to make a small movie about a big event or to make an indie movie about a big event, it is, yeah, if you don't get that tone right, the movie doesn't work.
No. No, I've always had problems with movies, too, that have at their core something is not true.
Right.
Just not true.
Exactly. Well, you know, it's funny.
I saw it.
Go ahead.
You know, piss off some people, but I don't care. There's a Grisham thing called A Time to Kill, and they made a movie out of that. And I was so upset when I saw that film. I was so upset I was talking in the theater. I was talking to B, and people were leaving because they thought I was a lunatic.
They're like, clearly he did not get cast in that movie.
I guess he did not. but essentially, the story was, it's implied that two white guys rape this black girl, and the father of the black girl, as the two white guys are, after they've been arrested, they're going into the courthouse to be arraigned, and the father goes and kills them, murders them both in front of everyone in cold blood. They've not been arraigned, they've not been charged, they've not had a trial. He murders them in cold blood. And the punchline to the movie was, he gets off and he goes to a picnic with the prosecutor's children. And I thought, this is the most despicable pile of shit I have ever seen. Does anybody, I mean, why, who hates our country and American jurisprudence so much that you would justify cold-blooded murder like that? Who hates white crackers so much that it's okay to murder them? Who's justifying murder? You don't believe in anything? Is that what that film said? And I, there, to a lesser extent, I've read scripts and I've seen movies where I go, hold on. This, at its core, is not true. And I so want to make sure that I'm never in or direct or write a film that, at its core, is not true. Because that's the jumping off place. Art be damned. Just make sure the story you're telling is true.
Right. I think the best directors are the most logical people.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a reason for that, because the reason the audience is smarter, I think, than any director is because they get to look at the finished product.
Mm-hmm.
And the finished product, as we all know, it was built piece by piece.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think that's the hardest thing about directing is knowing
it is.
How to be so far ahead that that you can anticipate those questions
yes.
and even ask those questions,
yeah.
right?
And for an actor to go, step into that role, an actor's purview is so small. I mean, we think about the tiny little moments. The way you do Hamlet is you do this little moment as well as you can and thoroughly and fully, and don't go on until you're finished. And when you're finished, go to the next moment. And when you finish all the moments, you've just done Hamlet. But our purview is that moment. You can't be worrying about the end. That moment, you got to put all. That's why potheads make such great actors. It makes you stupid. You can only do one thing at a time, which is the essence of great acting.
I think we have a new poll yeah. quote.
Potheads make great actors.
Well, look, what you're describing is
To finish my point. A director's purview is the entire world, and so it was a. It was a sock in the nose to me to step into that. I was completely unprepared.
Well, a couple things that come from that. Number one, when you talk about Hamlet and these bunch of little moments, what I hear you saying is it would be great if we could somehow not let the actor know any of what happens to his character.
You're right.
In the future, and we could shoot this thing in continuity, right?
Yeah.
Because when you think about it, that's the definition of telegraphing a performance, is you knowing where you're going before you,
yeah.
your character knows.
Interestingly, television is great about that,
because they're not
John
done
Wells
right
in particular. Yeah, I was on ER for a long time, and I did this scene, and I got the script the night before, because that's when I got it, and I go in and I fire George Clooney, and I went to the director and I said, where does this go down the line? He said, I don't know. They're sort of behind on scripts. I don't know. So what could I do except fire him completely and utterly so he stays fired?
Right.
That's the only thing I knew to do. I had a feeling George wasn't leaving the show, but I didn't know where it was going. And television is great that way. I mean, on Shameless, we kind of, John Wells will tell us in the broadest terms where we're going with the season and stuff like that, but we don't know what's happening. So a lot of times you act something in episode 7 and then 8 comes out and you go, oh, I wish I'd known that, but it's really good that you didn't know that.
That's real life, isn't
Makes
it?
Makes for better viewing,
right.
I think.
You talk about that idea of, as a director, having to know the whole world. And I think of the Coen brothers because, I mean, their prep and their plotting and their storyboarding is legendary mm-hmm. in knowing what they want. And I wondered if, you know, you've had the chance to work with Paul Thomas Anderson and the Coen brothers and all these great directors. And are you someone that studied what they were doing? I mean, because I would imagine it'd be easy as an actor to really focus on the actor-director relationship, but never really pay attention to what the director is telling the DP or how they're dealing with the production design or something. Like, were you a study like that?
No.
No?
No. And,
I mean, do you wish you had been when you were...
Well, I tried. Keith Carville, who produced Rudderless, said, I'm going to send you... DPs, directors of photography, what are you looking for? What are you... I don't know. I don't get it. You know, even they say, what's the palette? What are the colors? And I think, Jesus, I don't know. I think what I said to myself was, go back to the... let these things evolve. And they did. They did in the prep. And I think the key to it is having... longer amounts of prep, but I went to the story and I asked myself, what's the story we're trying to tell and what can I cut? Cut everything you can to tell that story. And as I would find myself getting florid with the design of the shots, I designed a lot of the shots mm-hmm. in Rudderless. The camera was always moving. I would take a deep breath and just go back, what can you cut away? And I just tried to keep it as simple. It's getting back to the script. Everything you need should be on the script in theory. I mean, the writer is not trying to fool us.
Sure.
He's trying to make it as clear for us as he can. And then at a certain point in the prep, I had this eerie feeling that we weren't making up a story. We were retelling a story. It was as if it had happened and we were trying to recreate it. It had become so real to all of us that it's as if the incident, the scenes had already happened, and we were trying to do them justice from the reality. It's hard to explain, but...
Well, that's what you want, right?
Because that's what you want.
You can't feel that probably until you really know your story really well. I think one of the greatest coups of that film is that you have Billy Crudup in the main role. And you know, I think that if you haven't gone through this on a very inside level of Hollywood, you may not understand this, of how often your first, second, third, fourth, fifth choice isn't available, can't do the time. For one reason or another, you go out to a lot of actors at a certain point.
Tell me about it.
But, you know, when I think about that role in that film, I can't think of another actor who could have done that better, who was the right age, who had the skills, who had the humility, who had the edge to him. And I just wonder if, first off, if he was one of your first choices, and if when you got him, was there this sigh of relief? Or did you even know how good he was going to be?
No, I didn't. I didn't. It's the casting process is one that still has me bollocksed. I don't know how to do it. One thinks, well, you've got all those actors out there. Pick the one you like. But the reality is, as you described it, who's available, who will do an indie, it's a nightmare. It's a nightmare. Plus, actors can be such assholes. People that I know, people I've had beers with and we've worked together, I send them a script and 6 weeks go by and they still haven't read it. I'm going, please just read it and say no.
And you start to feel insecure, right? Like, are they afraid to tell me they don't want to do it?
I sent you five emails. Are you dodging me? You really don't have an hour and 45 minutes that you can give your old pal Bill? This is, you know, talking about Billy Crudup, when I started directing, I realized chops, you know, actors who are skilled. Oh my God, I love them. Because especially when you do an indie, you get a lot of people who are first-timers or second-timers.
Cast and crew.
Yeah, it's the nature of the business. You know. And I laugh because, you know, Billy Crudup comes up and you can hear every word he says and he knows where the camera is and he makes it look magical. He just knows how to turn it on and it's there. It's all in the camera. And then you get somebody else, and they talk like this. They say, they're so earnest, and you go, cut, don't. You're pounding on the microphone, man. Don't do that, you know?
Exactly.
Or the actor is doing this, you know, and the sound guy's going, does he have to do that? And, you know, when Felicity Huffman and Billy Crudup walked on that set, I had all these things I was going to say to them. They just read the lines together, and I was smart enough to say, shut up, Bill. And I sat down, and I watched two stunning actors go at it like that. And I could have used anything those two people did. I could have used anything. I could hear every word. They knew where the camera was, and they were acting the bejesus out of it. And their continuity, you know, even though it was so improvisatory, one take was completely different than the next, but they always put the glass down at the same time.
Line,
so I could always cut.
Amazing.
You get people like that, and you go, oh my God, I love you so much.
I wondered a little bit about if you think someone without kids can make that film, because you get right into the tragedy. You do not set up a father-son relationship at all, and you leave the audience with a lot of room to put their own experience in.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you were saying that Billy's character didn't know his son very well, or if we can think we know our kids, but we this film sort of shows the chasm that we can have between people we love. And I just wonder if, to you, it was a father-son story at all.
Totally.
Yeah.
Interestingly, and this is me as a director learning the hard way on somebody else's money, I did shoot a lot of stuff that I cut. I shot a lot of stuff showing the relationship of Billy to his ex-wife, to his work, to his, you said it best. It's about a father-son. That's all you got to say to an audience. This is the dad, this is the son. Let them fill in the blanks and I had expended so much energy and capital on these scenes and we just cut them.
Well, I think that's the deal though, right? You don't really know till you get in the edit room exactly what's working, unless you are some sort of, you know, cyborg like the Coen brothers who can just shoot the shots they need. I think that, you know, To me, I think the magic of filmmaking, a lot of it is in the edit room.
Oh, totally. Totally. You know, the three films, the one you write, the one you shoot, the one you edit. But I gotta say, my least favorite phrase in this business is, we'll shoot it both ways.
As an actor or as a director?
Both.
Tell me why.
Because we don't have time to shoot it one way.
Exactly.
But you said it. I did better this time, but I think with chops, with experience, you can know more. But probably what you want is a big enough budget that you can give yourself some wiggle room. Because you never can tell. It's weird what'll catch up an audience.
Right.
So it's great if you have enough coverage and enough scenes and enough stuff that you can piece it together. And
now, Billy Crudup is a actor's actor. People who in the know that he is great, mm-hmm. and probably could care less whether he has a commercial career. I think he just loves to act. Mm-hmm. And I wondered, it brought up for me a question about, do you think actors like being directed by other actors?
I think so. I think I'm handling this part of it pretty well. You have to ask some of the actors I've directed, but in Rudderless, I didn't direct them much. I spent a lot of time getting the film in the can and with the camera. As I said, there were a lot of design shots, and I directed an episode of Shameless, and I directed them a lot. My fear was I would want everybody to act it the way I would act it. But I've been pretty good with watching what they do, and I think they appreciate the way I'm talking to them, which is, what's the objective? You know, what do you want? I go first. I say, this is a scene about blah, 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 and this is the moment right there.
Right. What's your responsibility to an actor when you come in to, I'm sure it's in as few words as possible, but you do have to impart some information to the mm-hmm. beginning, right? As an actor, what are you looking for right in that moment?
That's a great question, man. Here's what I want from a director. One, a general. I want a general. Because it's an army. There's an army of people. There's a giant machine that's making this film. And if you get a democracy going, it's going to be the longest days you've ever spent, and it's going to be a reeking pile of poop when it's done. You need a benign dictator, but I want a leader. I want somebody who will say, what do you think? What do you think? What do you think? This is what we're going to do. Let's shoot. And you move on. Because the main thing is keeping it on the schedule so that you're not languid in the morning and doing multiple takes and racing the sun in the evening. Because inevitably, one of your favorite scenes, an important scene, you get two takes because we've run out of time.
Sure.
That's bad directing. So I want a general, number one. Number two, I don't subscribe to this thing of a director has to mold himself to everybody's technique. I don't think so. I want a director who says, this is my technique, this is what I like, so that's what we're doing, because I'm the director, I'm directing this film.
Right.
So I feel as an actor, it's my job to give the director what he or she wants, not...
you have to adjust for the
yeah,
film you're on, right?
Yeah. He hired me, or she hired me. I didn't hire them.
Right. No, I think it's interesting, because you're someone who's had perspectives on both sides, but I think what I'm asking you is what makes a good actor's director, though. Like, you know, because there are directors that are so technically based and so shot-oriented that they really are counting on you to just come in and be totally prepared.
I got to say, I am, too. I am, too. I've only done indies, but I got to say, when somebody comes in and you got to direct them, in other words, it's not working and you need to direct them, that's a bad day. That's a bad day. Something's going to suffer. I need everybody to come in ready to rock. I got a little rehearsal on this one. I do talk. You know that thing you're talking about? I think you impart it with very few words. And I'm lucky because I come to the set and they've seen the way I act. And so kind of people know my aesthetic just because it's me. I'm also lucky on a set that because I'm in the tribe, I can say things that I don't think another director could say.
Well, give me an example of that.
I'll see, you know, we do a take, and then I see all the lighting people come in, and they're doing the light. I go, what are we doing? What are you doing? Well, he's a little out of his light. And I'll say, no, leave the lights there. Get in your light, man. What's the matter with you? Right. You want to be in the movie? Get in your light.
Right.
You know, the
so you
sound
can call,
man.
You can call actors out.
Yeah,
in
the
a way.
Sound man. Every take going. I said, "What's wrong?" He said, "I can't hear him." I said, "Speak the fuck up! Why did you come all the way here? I can't hear a word you're saying." You know, and they laugh because I called them out. You know, if you can't be seen, you can't be heard. You can't be an actor, and they all know that. This mumbling thing. I used to teach acting. We said it. People whisper when they're talking about sex or they're lying. They're talking about sex, money, or they're lying. So if you're not talking about sex or money or lying, speak up.
Exactly, yeah. Well, then my next question.
What?
So I guess the part three of that question about being on both sides of the camera is, did you learn, or what did you learn about acting from being a director? Like, from coming around to that side, what perspective did you gain?
I am much more forgiving of directors. I had no idea how difficult it is. I'm not being specious. I think being president of the United States is a very tough job. I'd put directing a film next. It blew my mind. It is so overwhelming. I was completely unprepared. On Rudderless, I came home from the first day of prep. This is the first day of prep, which is supposedly kind of an easy day, but there are 12-hour days, you know?
Sure.
I came home and I thought, I called Felicity and I said, I think my age is going to be a player in this. I thought, I'm dead. I can't go to work tomorrow. I can't do this. I can't do this 5 days in a row. Thinking like that, thinking and everything is so important. They're really important. I mean, the reality is half the stuff they ask you is just jive and it's annoying, but boy, you better answer them all. Otherwise, you'll end up with an actor in a blue shirt standing in front of a blue wall.
And you'll have a stylist saying, well, that's the color you picked.
Yeah, it's the one you picked.
Do you remember the feeling on the first day of photography? Like, I always think about that. You know, there's that bit of advice, which is, I think I read about it in a Sidney Lumet book first, which is, whatever you do, your first shot on the first day, make it one take and move on. And the crew will be like, okay, we're on notice here. But I wondered do you remember the feeling you had the first day? I mean, did you have butterflies? Were you nervous?
I was a mess.
You were a mess. See, I think that's interesting that you could walk on a set every day of your life for the last 30 years and then walk on a set as a director and feel nervous. It actually makes you feel good.
Every time you do a scene, sooner or later, you got to look at the whole crew and say, we're moving on. And for the rest of your life, those are the shots you've got.
So I want to go back several years and ask you about Fargo a little bit because, you know, it is the film probably a lot of people know you for. And I'm a huge fan of the Coen brothers. And at that point, I think I read that you, that was maybe the last time you had to seriously audition for something.
Kind of close. It takes a while before those watershed moments to take effect, but close.
Right. Okay, so you did audition for the film. When you got the script originally or got the part, was it one of those things where you were like, I have to have this role, this is me? What did you see in that script that made you, because obviously, I mean, other than Blood Simple, you probably didn't, no one knew a ton about those guys at that point, right?
Well, I read the script and I thought, well, this is written for me. This is me. This is totally me.
What did you see in Jerry Lundegaard that was totally you?
I'm that character. I'm Lutheran. I understood everything he did. I understand that sensibility. Luckily, I'd done a season at the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis, so that Minnesotan accent was not foreign to me at all. And they're good, solid, hardworking Yankee country folk. And I just thought it was a brilliant script written for me. Second time I read it, I realized that they described him as older than me and portly.
Uh-huh.
And my heart broke. It just sunk, because I'm neither of those things. But, you know, the question is always, did you know that would be a big hit? And yes.
Oh, when you read it, you did.
Totally.
No kidding.
Absolutely. I knew it was a life-changing opportunity.
So how did... Tell me about that audition process.
I was called in for a small part, the sheriff, and...
Oh, you weren't even called in for... No kidding. Okay.
So I read... I called my actor's gang and got two people to help me with it. It was only 2 pages long. And I had it down solidly. And Ethan said, that's real good. You want to read Jerry? I said, yeah, I really do. He said, you want to just take some time? So I went out in the hall. I'd already read the thing a bunch of times. And I came back in. And Ethan said, that's real good. You want to come back tomorrow? So as soon as I got home, started working on it. Stayed up until 4 o'clock in the morning until nobody would run it with me anymore. I got a tape about the accent. I called Minneapolis. I called directory assistants in Minneapolis a couple of times just to talk to some people. I went back in, and Joel and Ethan said, that's real good, thanks. Well, good. They're rather laconic, those two guys. They're two hippies who just have a lot of money to spend on films. And then I found out that they had gone to New York to audition. They were still auditioning. So I got my jolly, jolly ass on an airplane, and I flew to New York, and I crashed that audition.
You crashed it?
I think I let them know. I came in, and I said, I'm just worried you're going to screw up your movie by giving this role to someone else. I'm the guy. This is not a good idea for most actors to do. I think you can do it once in your career. When it doesn't work, it's really bad. But...
telling someone they don't know their movie as well as you do, that's bad?
I think I went further. I said to Ethan, who had just gotten a dog, I said, you don't give me this role, I'll shoot your dog. He laughed. Thank God.
That may have gotten you the role, considering their sensibility.
Maybe. I said, that's real good. That's all I ever got from that. That's real good.
And then how much longer after the New York audition?
It was a long time.
It was
weeks. I don't know if they offered it to somebody else who turned it down. I choose to believe not. But I have a little cabin in Vermont. When I lived in New York, I had this little cold water cabin. I just love that place. And I'd go up there every chance I could get, and I got the call when I was in my cabin.
Oh, really?
And I'd go up there by myself, because, like I said, it was... I learned one thing about relationships. You cannot have a meaningful relationship with a woman without plumbing.
That's not going to happen. That's good advice.
I don't care what they say. It's just not going to happen. So I was up there by myself, and I got the call. You got the role, and I was all by myself, you know, in the middle of Northeast Kingdom of Vermont, and I was running outside screaming. I knew it was big. I knew it was the Coen brothers, for Christ. And, you know, the role of the century and a genius script. I mean, I just thought, this is it. This is going to be big.
Okay, so another question that comes to mind is, what do you think looks easy about acting to the public that's actually really hard to pull off? Have you thought about that?
I think a lot of people look at an emotional scene where you got a lot of waterworks and you're really weeping and all of that stuff, and they think, that's tough. And it's not that tough, especially the waterworks. You got to get emotional. It's a little tough for me because, as I said, I'm Lutheran and we don't believe in emotion, but... it's not that tough. I mean, then a lot of people look at a nude scene or something like that, and they go, I could never do that. That's easy.
Right. Especially the specimen that you are.
No, it's just... I mean, it's probably not easy the first time, but it just... I don't know. Especially if you get older, it's just... It's no big deal. At least it's not to me. I'm sure it is to younger people, but... That's the big demarcation point. A lot of people say, I could do that, until they see someone walking around in his skivvies and they say, I couldn't do that.
Right, right. But is there something that, like, is the subtlety, is that the heart? Like, I don't know. I feel like I understand what you're saying, like, getting emotional. Maybe that isn't as hard as people think it is, but is there a converse of that that is more difficult to convey something a lot more subtle or...
Yeah, it's the simple stuff. I think it probably exists in all of us, but we want to do well. We want to do well. I've heard a lot of actors say, you know, it's a small role, but I think I can do something with it. And what I say to them is, oh, don't do that to yourself. Don't do something with it. Just do the role. Just do the role. Don't do something with it. You're going to be bad.
Is it like that thing, it takes confidence to do nothing?
Yes. Yeah, do your job and then stop. That takes guts.
Right.
You want to, you do a take and it's pretty good. And I think it's particularly difficult when you do a take and it's great, because you say to yourself, I'm going to do it a little bit better. And you can't do it a little bit better. That's a fool's errand.
It's very arrogant to think that on any given day you can wake up and make something great. I think a lot of circumstances outside of your control have to come together to make something great. Mm-hmm. Even if you're a solo artist, mm-hmm. a lot of elements have to be in place. And you know, the best ones, they're around and they're always putting in the effort.
Yeah.
And then those days start stacking up, right?
Also, she's a cruel mistress, this thing of art, because I kind of feel like the real true stuff, the stuff that makes people look up, comes from your self-conscious. Your self-conscious, that was a Freudian slip. Comes from your subconscious. That's where I don't think your subconscious can lie. Uh-huh. That's why we have Freudian slips. It just comes out. And so I think the purpose of all technique is to figure out how to loosen your subconscious so that you can do these unexpected things. I think the best acting, you're sometimes a bit of a spectator to yourself.
Well, I imagine being on a series where you shoot 60-page scripts in a week had to sharpen your acting a lot. And we talked about that a little earlier. But I have a few questions about Shameless. And I guess the first one would be, you know, as someone who was coming off of a lot of films, did you have any trepidation about signing on to a series that could go multiple seasons? I mean, that thing of like, gosh, in one way I would think that's the hallowed ground for an actor, like a steady job and a regular schedule. But on the other side, you know, is it scary to commit to something like that?
It is. You were talking about it with John Hamm. If you succeed wildly, you're kind of in actor's jail for a while.
Right.
You know, though, I mean,
I always think of Michael Richards that way.
Yeah.
I mean, to be so good
at
Kramer.
Kramer's the president now.
Exactly.
Oh, look, Kramer's the killer.
Kramer's a detective, you know, and then eventually you're going to have a director saying, well, do a little pratfall on the way into your detective office.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I can see where that comes from.
But it's just the price you pay.
Right.
You know, you're in actor's jail for a while, but it goes away. You grow older. You go to New York, you do some, so you just have to wait it out. But it goes away in a couple of years. And you end up with lots and lots of money. So you feel better about the whole pause.
It's a really nice jail.
It's a nice...
With a pool and
some cars. I think the other thing that scared me, I really wanted Shameless. I wanted to do TV. Felicity loved it, and I thought, I'm not getting work that I find scintillating. I want to do a series. The only other thing that's scary, and it's still scary, is you get in a bad show. And I mean, the bad shows will die quickly, but even if it's a good show, they have a tendency to live one or two seasons past their expiration date. And those are rough seasons.
I see, right. Well, I can imagine that, you know, one of the big unknowns would be, hey, they could write a pilot in a few episodes, but does this have legs? Can it go further? With Shameless, there's a strange thing that happened, which is categorically it changed from a drama to a comedy, at least in the eyes of the Emmys or whatever. I mean, I think the best cinema is both a drama and a comedy.
And I agree.
And I don't imagine you're doing that much different at all, at least what I can tell.
Oh, nothing
different.
From
when it was a drama. But was there any discussion of that on set of, hey, guys, we're a comedy now? Or
No.
There's nothing. It was just, let's put it in a different category.
You know, they had to make that decision. I don't even know who they are, but they had to make that decision way early on. And there's some heavy themes. I mean, it wasn't a stupid mistake. We deal with some heavy themes in the thing. But the irony is, We hadn't been inside an award ceremony in 4 years. And then they changed the category, and I got an Emmy nomination. And what I had done that year was die. I was dying the entire year. I was in
entire
a hospital.
Fourth season, you were
I
dying,
was losing
right?
weight, and it was about as funny as colon cancer. And so I'm nominated for best actor in a comedy. I don't think I won that year. I don't know. I don't know. The awards people don't quite get our show.
Well, it's funny.
Rough. It's not for everybody. It's really rough.
You know, in season four, he gets sober because he's dying. And it brought up a question for me about research. And I've talked to actors that go way deep into research. And then I thought, well, how do you research Frank? And how do you decide how to play Frank Gallagher? And I thought, well, obviously, Bill didn't go out and get drunk and film himself. But then I thought, okay, if you play a drunk character for 3-4 seasons, then all of a sudden he's sober.
Ain't you clever?
Do you get, is it like a new person?
Oh my God, it was an amazing experience. And talk about, well, talk about bad acting. I realized I took on this way that I talked when I was Frank. It was just bullshit because he was loaded all the time.
Right.
So when I go into Frank mode.
He was like on his pulpit or a little bit.
Yeah, when I go into Frank mode, I'd talk funny and it was hard to not do it. And it was a good thing. It was an amazing thing to play him clear-eyed and sober. And he turned, the character became so much more vicious.
Did you approach that academically or did you just,
No.
Was it sort of from your gut?
Yeah, it's the difference between putting a buffer between you and the other actors, you know, the drunkenness that you put on.
And which version do you like playing better?
It's awfully fun to be drunk. There is no wrong, you know what I mean? I don't know where they're going to go with Frank. We shall see. I mean, last season he was, every prescription drug he could beg, borrow, or steal he was on, so he was kind of loopy.
Right. No, I love that. I mean, I love the scene at the table where all the donors, the organ donors, get all the organ recipients get together, and this family who lost their son.
Weren't they great?
Think they, you know, it's like, oh, we're having dinner with our son one more time, and then you're drinking, and you're the liver.
You're the liver.
And you're like, I got 8 years.
I've talked about it. The guy who was the lung says, oh, to hell with it. Can't get a cigarette.
I mean, that's the thing about Shameless.
They are shameless.
It's a total adult pleasure. Mm. But I do think about that. I do think, you know, because even sometimes when my girls come to work and we're editing something, there's an adult theme going on, and they're just not the age yet. Mm-hmm. You know, when I have to say, well, you can't watch this right now. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that's hard for me. And I would imagine early in the show, it was probably hard to tell your daughters, oh, you can't come watch me work, right? I mean, did that come
right.
up?
Yeah, you know, there was a picture of me wearing nothing but pasties on our refrigerator, and they kept saying, why are you... That's how Daddy makes a living. but you know, be prepared. Well, you probably know from your 16-year-old, it just, in a year, they go from innocent to knowing everything.
Yeah, well, God, it goes fast. When you're in the middle of the they need everything stage, it feels slow, and now I'm on that train now. It feels like it's faster and faster, and the school years are going by quicker, and I mean, as you well know, it's...
I live with all women.
Me too. 3 daughters and a female dog.
I got a male dog.
Well, I was an idiot. I got a female dog, and...
And we talk, my dog and me, we're...
Can your dog come over to my house? You don't
yes.
have to come over, but if you could send your dog, maybe I could get a little...
He will give you a charge. But we have nannies, you know, because Felicity, we can never tell. You know, sometimes it comes up, so even though my daughters don't need help, we have to have help there. So there are all these women at my house. It's really weird.
Well, you can come here anytime.
And I become invisible, you know? They start... talking about their heavy flow or some tampon. And I go, excuse me, I'm at the table too, you know?
Yeah, you got to just get out some prostate talk.
Yeah,
you
know? Right?
Yeah. Well, listen, it's fascinating to talk to you. And I've loved your work for so many years.
Thank you.
And it's such a pleasure to have you
on. Were we saying goodbye? I thought we were going to talk about woodworking.
Well, I'd love to do that. I have a whole hour of questions on woodworking, but okay. Our producer is telling me we're out of time.
Him? He's a producer?
Well, he's the sound man, but...
Oh, there's no producer here. Why can't we talk about woodworking?
Technically, that's true, but just knowing that we've already gone about an hour, that...
Here's the thing about finishes. Do you know about fuming?
I don't know about fuming.
You don't put...
Hey folks, you've reached the end of another episode of Off Camera. I hope you're liking the show. And remember, if you want to get the full Off Camera experience, go to offcamera.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Off Camera Show or me at Sam Jones. And if you want to get really personal, send me an email, sam@offcamera.com. And if you're not already subscribed to this podcast, go to iTunes and subscribe. And while you're there, take a minute on iTunes and give us a rating. Anything above 4 stars is acceptable. And be sure to join me next time when I sit down with actor, writer, director, and Uber collaborator, Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
I quit acting for a while because I'd always loved acting, but all my friends were kind of going off and getting started in a way, saying like, what am I gonna do? What am I gonna be? And I wanted that. Maybe I'll have something to do with acting or movies or TV, but maybe I won't. Maybe I'll do something that has nothing to do with that. I very much wanted to have an experience like a normal kid. And that was important to me to kind of get to ask myself those questions and give myself that fresh start.
Plain and simple, I just love people who make stuff. And Joe makes a heck of a lot of stuff. Yes, he makes films and writes and directs them too. But he also makes songs and books and art and any number of creative media projects. And the best part is, he created a platform for thousands of other people to make stuff too. In this episode, Joe shares the backstory on Hit Record, as well as his writing-directing debut, Don John, and why he chose to steer his acting career off the expected path. He also offers up some thought-provoking conversation on the role of technology in our lives and the ability we have to change who we are. Tune in for a big dose of optimism. See you next time, off camera.